Podcast. I'm Paul Amory, the founding editor of New Money Review, your leading source of news coverage, comment and analysis of cryptocurrencies, peer-to-peer and digital money. You can find our content and sign up to receive article updates at newmoneyreview.com. In this podcast, I'm joined by Dave Birch, author of a book published last year called Before Babylon, Beyond Bitcoin. As well as writing books and consulting for the firm he helped set up, Consult Hyperion, Dave is also a visiting professor at Surrey University. In his book, Dave predicts we are in for a period of significant turmoil and change in the global monetary system. He says that technological improvements will combine with growing demand for change from the world's population to result in many new forms of money in the decades ahead. Meanwhile, the post-World War II consensus involving national fiat currencies issued by central banks may start to break down. I started the podcast by asking Dave why he thinks we're in for such an era of seismic change.
Well, I think that the system of money that we have now, which is what people broadly call the Washington Consensus, the post-war structure of the IMF and central banks and fiat currencies and this sort of thing, was set up to handle a particular kind of economy, particular kind of society. And historically, when societies have been through big changes, money changes as well. So we're about to go through some big changes. I think probably the crash of a decade ago made people think about the infrastructure that we have and whether it's really fit for purpose. At the same time, people have been thinking we're now into a kind of post-industrial economy, but we're still using the money of the last age, which may not be optimal any longer. And also the long-term decentralizing nature of the technology, which has gradually shifted the power. You know, 1,000 years ago, it was the king who was in charge of the mints and the money. And then we had this kind of medieval settlement between the, if you like, the aristocracy and the merchant classes. And we began to see banks. And then we have the Industrial Revolution and central banks and the gold standard. It was one of Clinton's economic advisors who said that when he died, he wanted to come back as a bond trader because it's bond traders who had all the power. So you see this, you know, this gradual decentralization, the distribution of power. And I think the new technologies that we see now very much continue that tradition. We have technology that gives us the ability to distribute money further. And at the same time, we have a pressure which says the current system isn't working for everybody. I mean, you can see this in several levels. I mean, first of all, you know, calculations of inequality and so on. It's a well-worn meme now that globalization hasn't been working for everybody. There are shortages of money in some places, the wrong kinds of money. I think you see, I mean, I refer to it myself. I am puzzled when people say, well, of course, one of the reasons that the euro can't succeed in the long term is because the economic situation in Greece and the economic situation in Germany are so completely different that you can't have one money and one monetary policy to cover both of them, which I think is true, which then leads me to wonder, well, why isn't that true in England? Because the economic situation in London and the economic situation in the north of England are as different as Germany and Greece. Why do we have one money? And there was the argument that 300 or 400 years ago, the way to minimize trading costs was to have these currency areas. I'm sure that was true and it was optimal for the time. But in a world of mobile phones and laser beams and satellites, I'm not really sure if it's true anymore. So that's why I think you have the technological opportunity to create something new. And at the same time, you have these economic and social pressures to move away from the current system.
You mentioned in your book, you cite Glyn Davis's History of Money, and you mentioned that he wrote in his book, which I think was published about 20 years ago, that every technological revolution in money has led to less centralized control. Now, yeah. You mentioned the crash of 2008 and that central banks have arguably come into a position of much greater power since then through quantitative easing and zero or near zero interest rates. What makes you think that in the new era of perhaps technological innovation that central banks are going to be willing to give up their control so easily?
Well, I mean, the response to the crash was not a technological response. I mean, actually, it is in one interesting way. I've spoken to a number of people. I'm steadily becoming persuaded of this view myself, actually, that one of the ways to understand Bitcoin is more as a protest movement in response to the 2007-2008 crash, as much as a new currency or a new payment system. And I think that's kind of a very interesting way of thinking. We didn't have a technological revolution in response to the crash. A technological revolution which would have meant, for example, more transparency, more accountability. We didn't get that yet. If there is going to be a technological revolution, and obviously I come from the technology side, so I think this is true. And by the way, I think that revolution probably isn't Bitcoin and so on. It's the things that we build on top of them. If you talk about tokens and ICOs and things at the moment, people think you're crazy. But there's every reason for thinking that a properly regulated market in these new forms of bearer instruments will actually be very big and very successful, and a very new way of solving some old problems.
Dave, perhaps we could come back to ICOs and tokens. I'm really interested in your views on that topic. But I'd like to just go back to perhaps the textbook definitions of money, which you talk about quite a lot in your book. And depending on who you ask, there are three or four definitions of money. You use four, and we also use four on the site. But money has four purposes: unit of account, medium of exchange, store of value, and means of deferred payment. Now, I suppose we've all become used to using a single form of money for all four, but you describe very well in your book that in the past that's not necessarily been the case. And you cite an example in, I think, North America, where in the early era of the settlers, people used four different types of money, one for each function. So perhaps you could elaborate a bit on that and explain why you think we might be going back to earlier forms of money where people used different monies for different things.
Well, I think two things about this. I think, first of all, that the technology allows us to uncouple those different functions. And because I have a slight streak of technological determinism in me, that means I think it will happen. But there's something else going on there, which is the history of forms of money. One of the stories I use in the book is the story of the tally sticks in post-conquest Britain. The Norman blockchain, as I like calling them. So here you have a situation where you have a new technology, which is these wooden sticks, which are used to record a mechanism for deferred payment, essentially. So I'm the king, and you're the sheriff of Nottingham, and we agree that next year you're going to pay me £1,000 in taxes. So we make some notches on a stick that represent £1,000, and then we split the stick in two, and you keep half of it and I keep half of it. And then next year, when you show up, by the way, this is where the English phrase tallying up comes from. Next year, when you show up, we can put the two bits of the stick together and you can hand me the £1,000. And we can all agree that this is what you intended to give me. And you haven't cheated me and I haven't changed the amounts and all this sort of thing. So those sticks soon became a store of value. And people would buy these sticks from each other. Because if I'm a merchant, carrying around £1,000 or hiding £1,000 under my bed is quite inconvenient. Whereas having a stick that will give me £1,000 next year is rather more convenient. And then, of course, as time goes on, these things become a medium of exchange because people actually begin trading the sticks around for each other with appropriate discounts for space and time. You know, you'd pay more for a stick that was going to be redeemed next month than one that's going to be redeemed next year. And you'd pay more for a stick that was going to be redeemed somewhere near you so you could go to Nottingham and collect your money rather than a stick that was going to be redeemed far away. So a market grew up and these sticks went into circulation. Now, if we generalize that and say, well, okay, we have a new technology which gives us certainty into the future, which I'm not sure Bitcoin does yet, but you get the general point. And then we add ease and convenience, so it becomes a store of value. And then it becomes traded and part of a market, and then becomes a medium of exchange. You know, you can see how technological progress interrelates with those different categories of money. And I think that tells us something about the future. So I think that says when we create this new form of digital money, it will probably go through the same kind of process. So to begin with, it will be claims on assets, which of one form or another, which become, you know, recognized and enforceable and all this sort of thing. And people trust them. And then people will take those claims and start using them as a store of value because they're more stable and they have a, you know, long-term certainty around them, just as people do with bonds and things now. And then they become tradable in a market and they become a form of money themselves. And I said in the book, you know, it sounds crazy to us that companies and individuals would hold these portfolios of claims on assets rather than money as an intermediary. But that's because it's hard to think about when you're thinking about managing it yourself. You know, why would I want some water and some kilowatt hours and some PlayStation time and some bus trips and, you know, all of these other things instead of just having money that I can use for any of them? But of course, if it's your bot doing this for you, you know, at the end of your smartphone, you know, with networks of supercomputers in the background, actually, it's not complicated at all. And the idea that those assets would then begin to substitute for the intermediary money we have right now as part of this process of decoupling the implementations of the different kinds of money, it doesn't seem to me to be that much of a stretch of the imagination.
Dave, one of the things that the recent Facebook scandal has caused some people to suggest is that we may want to move away from this Silicon Valley model of monopolies making money out of our individual data to a
decentralized form of control of data,
where we all have our own digital identities or multiple identities that we control through our own wallets. How realistic a vision is this, given that it raises lots of questions about security, how we manage our own identities, whether the technology is user-friendly enough? What's your views on that?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree that the digital identity issue, if we can call it that, is an absolutely central issue. We need to come up with some sort of settlement, if you like, in that space. We need to come up with something that works for government, admits the legitimate interests of law enforcement, works for individuals and delivers privacy, and works for companies so they can make a reasonable business model as well. What we have at the moment, it varies greatly. So in some countries, India, for example, you have an absolutely centralized system where you have one identity and it's controlled and authorized by the government. The polar opposite would be somewhere like the UK, where there's no identity system, no identity cards, no one knows what's going on at all, same as in the US. You have all sorts of private data that's being collected and managed and monitored in a very unsatisfactory way, whatever you think of the merits or otherwise. There's a pressure to come up with a better way forward. I'm unconvinced that devolving this down to the level of the individual is the right way forward. It might be, but I've not seen any convincing arguments in that direction. That's largely because the management of individual identity, you know, most people neither know nor care enough about the topic to actually do it. But it's also quite hard. You know, what happens if I lose my identity? How do I get it back? What happens if I forget my password and all this sort of thing? So, and because I'm old and I tend to think in terms of existing structures, I sort of think, well, you know, banks are the regulated institutions. They already do KYC. They would seem to me to be the natural people to manage this for us. And certainly I would trust my bank to look after my personal data and not have it hacked or given away without my permission. But, you know, there are other possibilities. There are other people that could take that role. What I do think, and actually the UK is a really interesting example of this at the moment. What I do think is if there's not going to be some government solution, then we need a private sector solution that is richer than the ones we see at the moment. So you can see some good examples of how, I mean, it's me in Belgium and things like that. Bank ID in Norway. These are great systems and they work in great ways. But they're not rich enough because, for example, if I go to log into a website, I might want to log in as, you know, Dave Birch at work. I might want to log in as Dave at home. I might want to log in as John Doe. I might want to log in with my, you know, football supporter identity. You know, these different personas and the partitioning between them are a fundamental way of preserving privacy as we move forward in this very interconnected world. I mean, I hate to be the pretentious so-and-so that is the first to bring McLuhan into any conversation. But, you know, he did say an awfully long time ago, before there were World Wide Webs and internet tubes, McLuhan thinking about what an always online interconnected world would look like, said that current forms of identity, and he was talking about identity cards in particular, don't make any sense in a world in which your identity is formed by, you know, essentially relationships between you know, nodes in this interconnected space. And I think he's completely right about that. We need the new thinking.
You think that the younger generation will be perfectly comfortable with this concept of multiple IDs and operating in different communities and under different identities?
I remember many years ago, an old friend of mine, Steve Bobrick, gave a presentation, and he was talking about the way people use multiple email addresses as a sort of proxy for having different identities, and the way in which basically young people had lots of them. This is in the old days when young people used to use email. I mean, it doesn't apply anymore. And young people had lots of them. And then as you get a bit older, that you narrow them down a bit and you end up with two or three. But then oddly, as people retired, they started having more email addresses again because they joined more communities for hobbies and all that sort of thing. And that's always sort of stuck with me, you know, this idea that, you know, you have lots of different identities when you're young, when you're exploring and trying to find out who you are. And then when you get a bit older, these collapse down into basically your work identity, your home identity, and your leisure or hobby identity. And then, you know, when you get older, you retire, you've got more time, you start to have more identities again, because then you have your, you know, maybe your book group identity isn't the same as your gardening identity or whatever. So I think it sounds funny to say, well, we need a system that lets people have lots of different identities, but I think we do. And
how many of those identities are likely to have some form of money associated with them?
Well, clearly there are going to be – I'm rather in favor of having a common financial services passport, for want of a better description. So at least one of those identities ought to be your, you know, your money identity, so to speak. But others could have money. You know, I mean, your hobby identity might have – money attached to it because you grow and sell vegetables or something, but you just don't want that mixed up with your other bank accounts and the other parts of your life. So I think multiple identities are a fundamental way forward. And
Dave, do you think we're going to be required to deal with? Let's look at the cryptocurrency market as an example. There's been an absolute explosion of different tokens and different projects there. Probably a lot of them will not survive, but some may do. And are we going to have wallets to handle all of them, or different wallets handling some of them? And how do you see that evolving?
Well, but you won't. I'm not sure if you, as the individual, will actually deal with a lot of this stuff. Because, I mean, for example, think about how this would work in practice. If there's 10,000 or a million different currencies, you can't possibly keep track of all of them and decide which of them have the long-term stability that you want, or which of them you need for your holiday next year. Or, I mean, you just can't keep track of that. But a bot can. So I might well go and download the Saga bot to look at. I should say, for foreign listeners, Saga is the organization for people over, is it 50? I can't remember. So Saga is where you go and look for your deals on holidays and travel insurance and home insurance and that sort of thing when you get a bit older. Well, I might decide that I trust them to look after the interests of persons such as myself. So I'll go and download their bot, and their bot will manage my different currencies for me. So when I go onto Amazon and I click the button to buy something, I will see that price displayed in something that makes sense to me. Now, let's say London money, because obviously by that time London will have its own currency. But when I press the buy button, what happens under the hood, and which basket of currencies get exchanged between my bot and Amazon's bot, I couldn't say. I mean, I just won't be part of that conversation. It's too complicated. And I'm not interested in it.
We need to monitor the you know, there presumably there'll be some kind of transaction fees going on below the surface.
Well, that's what I would expect my Saga bot to take care of, precisely. You know, I would expect it to be optimized for persons of my age and disposition. Other people might want to download, I don't know, the Virgin bot or the who's that famous singer guy that does all the technology stuff? William bot. Or somebody else might want to download the Manchester City bot. I don't know. But I don't think people will be dealing with these things themselves. And we probably haven't really adjusted to thinking about the future financial services marketplace, where it's my bot and the Barclays bot and the regulator's bot interacting with each other at a far higher speed and with much greater intensity than the information passes around right now.
So where does this leave sterling, the dollar, the euro, whether in their current forms or whether in a new form of crypto sterling, crypto dollar? Are they going to be gradually edged out from the future landscape, or do they still have a very important role to play?
Well, if you look at things like crypto sterling or Bitcoin, as I like to call it, there are some very good reasons for wanting to move to a central bank digital currency, not cryptocurrency, but digital currency. And in fact, the Bank of England's own working paper on this, I can't remember the exact, I don't have it in front of me, but I think they said the GDP boost of shifting to a digital currency would be 3 or 4%, something like that. I mean, not marginal, pretty significant.
And where do those gains come from?
Well, I think there are two areas, really. So one is, the general efficiency that comes from having a digital currency everywhere. So you don't need ATMs and armored cars and trucks driving around, all that sort of thing. But the other is and these are my words, not theirs, cash doesn't have an API, whereas a digital currency would. And so you could imagine people will build all sorts of new, interesting products and services on top of the national digital currency platform. The one thing that I think people don't appreciate when they're kicking around these kind of ideas, though, is that the current system, remember, only a tiny proportion of the money that's in circulation is in the form of central bank notes and coins. It's, 3 to 4% in the UK. Almost all of the money that's in circulation is in the form of bank credit. And so if you have the central bank creating money, then you have to work out what the commercial model for central banks, for commercial banks is going to be. And that's a complicated problem. And well beyond the remit of this podcast. I think people don't quite understand how money works. And so they think, we'll just have this Bank of England create their own digital currency and we'll all use that. Well, okay, but then how is Barclays going to lend me money to buy a car? Because at the moment, they can just make it up. And if they can't, if we have to go back to some sort of Mary Poppins world of banking, where in order to lend me 10 grand to buy a car, they need 10,000 widows and orphans to come and deposit their pound at a time, we're going to get a bit stuck. So it needs a little bit more thinking through than that.
But it is possible that this could, I understand why the central banks are perhaps nervous about doing this. They don't want to disintermediate the banks, to use a horrible word. But you could see where they're coming from. But it is possible, given the technology, that could be the outcome if the banks do get marginalized.
Yes, I think that's an entirely possible outcome. It's not going to happen tomorrow. And it would require a long-term strategy to make it work, because this migration from bank-created money to central bank-created money would need to be managed and implemented properly. But I wouldn't rule it out. It could well happen. You're right.
Because you've shown an example in your book of what happened in Kenya, where the payment services have switched to something provided by the mobile telephone network and the banks are not playing a role at all.
Yes. Well, actually, that's actually a very interesting example to look at, because of course, I'm of the opinion, and I'm not entirely disinterested, because as you'll remember, Consult Hyperion was the company that did the original feasibility study on M-Pesa some time ago. But I've always felt that it's an interesting example for another reason. M-Pesa is an example of regulatory innovation. The technology for mobile money was around for a long time. And what happened in Kenya was that there was a little regulatory window opened up, which meant that the telco could get out there and start distributing it before the banks could go whining to the regulators and get it blocked. If you look at countries which should be mobile payment powerhouses, places like India and Nigeria, where you've got, you know, young populations, millions of smart entrepreneurial people, you know, there's smartphones all over the place, it didn't happen. And that's because the regulators basically made up these, you know, you had to have a bank involved, you had to have bank partners and all this sort of thing. So Kenya is a great example, but I think it's an example of regulatory innovation as much as technology innovation.
Dave, let's go back to Bitcoin, which you mentioned at the beginning of our interview. You sure. mentioned that as time has gone on, you've started to see Bitcoin as more of a protest movement than perhaps many people see it as. Is Bitcoin then the continuation of the Occupy Wall Street movement by other means? It's, you know, as most people, perhaps, well, as many people know, the first block of the Bitcoin blockchain has a reference to bank bailouts in it. So some people have taken that as a criticism of the existing system.
Yeah. I do kind of think that. I mean, I've always been from the, and I remember going to the very first Bitcoin conference in Europe, which was in Prague. And I remember being fascinated by the technology because obviously I've been in this space for a long time. And the antecedent technologies, you know, Chomian blinding and Adam Back's hash cash and all this sort of thing were of great interest to me. So the assembly of those technologies into Bitcoin was absolutely fascinating. But I was never completely convinced by Bitcoin as a currency itself. And I realize I might be out on a limb here, but I just don't see it as a viable long-term replacement. Now, for currencies. Now, Craig Wright, who is the Australian chap that claimed to be Satoshi Nakamoto at some point, I think, wrote a blog piece a long time. It's been deleted now, but and he said something to the effect of the way to think about Bitcoin isn't as a currency or a payment system, but as a sort of global security system that we all have an interest in maintaining. Because it provides a security infrastructure which is quite independent of any third parties. And that's actually quite an interesting point. You know, the idea that you have this global security system and then you build on top of it these new applications, and those are the things that actually form the new financial system. I know that seems to me to be more interesting and more plausible than the idea that Bitcoin is going to, you know, overthrow the US dollar and bankrupt the Federal Reserve.
But you also make the point in your book, Dave, that if it did work in such a way, if Bitcoin did fulfill its objectives, then you said the rich and the powerful will enthusiastically adopt this new store of value to remain beyond the reach of democratic accountability, which I think is an important point. But I suppose a counter argument would be that if you go back to the gold standard or the use of gold and silver as money in, for many hundreds of years, the gold deposits around the world have never been equally distributed. Some countries had, you know, much more of the bullion than others. And so it's perhaps a utopian idea that you could have a new form of money that is egalitarian in its roots.
Well, Bitcoin certainly isn't that. I think people who talk about the digital gold standard and Bitcoin as the new gold, by and large, and this is a sweeping generalization, I apologize for people that are offended by it, by and large, don't know anything about the gold standard. You know, they're not versed in the history of Main Street versus Wall Street and the cross of gold and all this sort of thing. And I can't resist teasing them by pointing out that it did result in, ultimately, you know, global depression and world war. So I don't quite know where the nostalgia for it comes from. But the idea that that if it did work, it would enforce inequality, I mean, that plays to the, you know, you and I know that in reality, Bitcoin isn't quite as anonymous as people say. But of course, people will build more anonymous versions of things like Zcash and Monero and stuff like that. Well, if that's true, and those were to become globally adopted, and then I think my point holds, which is that the idea that this would somehow help people who are poor and marginalized is fanciful, because actually what it would mean is the people who are rich and control all the assets would then be absolutely beyond any form of democratic control or accountability.
I suppose you could argue that that's already happened, Dave, with the Silicon Valley having an enormous power over our everyday lives, and
I wouldn't.
Computer scientists and cryptographers already rule the world in that sense, and perhaps beyond the existing structures of accountability.
No, I agree with that. But on the other hand, I would say we do at least live in a world where banks do occasionally get fined for not doing their AML duties properly. If we were to move into a world where, you know, the 1% could store and move their money around with absolutely no trace and no accountability, I'm not sure that's a universal benefit.
But that's not necessarily Bitcoin, as you said, because of the fact that Bitcoin's transactions are recorded and can be presumably tied to an identity.
Yeah, no, and I've said facetiously more than once, if I were the law enforcement agencies, I would be trying to persuade all criminals to use Bitcoin because at the moment they use $100 bills and those are much less traceable.
Right.
So yes, that's a good point.
And let's come back to ICOs. You mentioned early on that you saw ICOs as a potentially revolutionary new technology, or at least you hinted at that, if I understood you correctly. Could you expand on that and explain why?
Yeah, well, I think, I'm not sure if you feel this way, Paul, but I do think, you know, one of the hallmarks of intelligence is being able to change your mind about things in the light of new. And at first, I just thought the whole ICO thing was mad and it was just a whole scam. But then I began to talk to extremely intelligent people who were working in that space who began to make me think more and more about the details and took the time out to help me understand how this, how the technology worked and where it was going. And as I've looked at that more and more, I became more and more convinced that the long-term prognosis for the token marketplace was actually very positive. And the reason for that is because it creates digital assets that can be traded without clearing and settlement. And so therefore leads to much lower cost markets. And when you add on top of that, the transparency and what I like to call the ambient accountability of shared ledger infrastructures, you can see a new kind of financial services marketplace forming there. So I've written a few times about this already. And in fact, I'm working on a new book at the moment, which touches on this. So I'd begun to think from a technological perspective that actually the token marketplace was deserved more attention than it was getting, and shouldn't be dismissed just as a for scams. I had the great good fortune to interview. So at Money 2020 in Singapore a few weeks ago, I had the great good fortune to interview a chap called Jonathan Larson on the main stage. And Jonathan is the head of corporate venture capital for Ping An, which is gigantic. In fact, it's the second biggest insurance company in China, I think. And he has something like $1 billion under management in his Global Voyager Fund. And I asked Jonathan about tokens. I was curious about the response of what I would see as mainstream, sensible, scale financial services providers. I asked him about tokens, and he said, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but he said essentially, once the token market is properly regulated, then we're going to tokenize everything. We think tokens are going to be absolutely massive. So when I hear someone like that, who is he's not a techno-utopian, deterministic hype merchant like me, he's a guy that runs a serious financial services business. So when I hear people from that side saying that, or confirming what I think from the technological side, that makes me pay attention. And as a consequence, I think that I think I'm justified in saying that it's going to be huge.
So for anyone involved in the conventional financial services business, let's say asset managers, stock exchanges, clearing and settlement systems, they need to be paying very close attention to what's going on, because they might find themselves on the wrong fork of history, to use
I think they do need to pay attention to it. And I think if you're looking at the sort of strategic big picture, having a strategy in place for tokenization makes complete sense. It really does.
Dave, thank you very much for a fascinating interview. Thank you very much for your time, and look forward to chatting in future.
Not at all, Paul. I was flattered to be asked, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.